Morning. Let's continue our study in Mark 14. We're not going to talk about a very large section of Mark 14, given that it really is in many ways the Christological climax and a huge climactic point within Mark. I think it merits plenty of discussion all on its own. Let's begin, as we are wont to do, by reading from our Old Testaments. Turn to Psalm 110. Psalm 110, the Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Yahweh sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments. From the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. Yahweh has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He shall shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chiefs over the wide earth. He will drink from the brook by the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head. Psalm 110. Let's also read from Daniel. Daniel 7. I believe both of which we've read in the context of Mark already. This we've talked about a number of times. Daniel 7, starting at 9. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, and I looked. The beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burnt with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their domination was taken away, and their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. And his kingdom, one that will not be destroyed. Now, back to Mark 14. Starting in verse 53. Then they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and elders and experts in the law came together. And Peter had followed him from a distance, up to the high priest's courtyard. He was sitting with the guards and warming himself by the fire. The chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find anything. Many gave false testimony against him, but their testimony did not agree. Some stood and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days build another not made with hands. Yet even on this point, their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, have you no answer? What is this that they are testifying against you? But he was silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest questioned him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, why do we still need witnesses? You have heard this blasphemy. What is your verdict? They all condemned him as deserving death. Then some began to spit on him, to blindfold him, to strike him, and with their fist, saying, prophesy. The guards also took him and beat him. So let's talk about some general setting things. What's going on here? How this fits in with some of the immediate context? And then we'll talk about some of the more the really interesting and very pertinent Old Testament usages here. The what's going on in Jesus' mind, what's going on in their minds, and how that might be different than how we might normally read this verse. So in setting-wise, we've already seen the arrest. That's already happened. We talked about that last Lord's Day. The arrest has already happened. They're now bringing him here. Peter, true to his word, has stood now longer than any of the other disciples. They have all fled. They're all gone. Now Jesus is not, Peter is not an example of great faith in that, as you very well know, he's going to deny Jesus soon enough. But he at least, over all of the other disciples, is following along, hanging around on the outside. Now, some people call this a trial. This probably is not technically a trial. It didn't follow their normal standards for what they would do in a trial. They never held these kind of capital offense, these capital crime trials, because clearly that's where they were going, right? This was an event. This was not looking for what he did. It was an event purely around how can we frame him to kill him. That's entirely what this was. This was no real trial at all. And the reality is they did not even have the authority to kill him. I mean, they could have done it themselves. That's what they did with Stephen, right? They stoned Stephen without putting him through a proper Roman trial. They could have done that, but they didn't want to, probably because they were afraid. And so they were going to find some charges. They were going to find some way to get this guy put to death and then take him to the Romans and actually have it done. So the setting is in the high priest's courtyard. Now, this is probably a two-story building, big courtyard, probably two stories there in the courtyard. The reason why is it says in the very next paragraph, now Peter was below in the courtyard. So this is a big building, probably a public area. You might would think that for an official of at least the Jewish state. Peter's hanging out. He's close, right? So it's not like he had to go through the front door and go through his guards. He's hanging out in the semi-public area. Then there's the courtyard right on the inside. Peter's down below. The high priest is probably above, and who knows, maybe the rest of the Sanhedrin above, looking down at Jesus in this fake trial. So that's the setting. So Jesus at this point is alone. And we are really getting towards what is the main point of this, and ultimately that is going to be Jesus' death. Now this is also a very ironic passage. From the reader's point of view, what do we know about Jesus and what do we know about what's going to happen? We know Jesus is ultimately going to be the victor, right? We know what Jesus says in verse 62. Yes, 62. We know that's true. We know he's actually going to be vindicated. We know in the end he's actually going to win. From their perspective, this guy's just a really big troublemaker. So it's irony. In Mark, we know the big picture. The characters, well, Jesus knows. Other than Jesus, none of the characters have a clue what's really going on. And another ironic thing about this is they are trying to get Jesus condemned, and they can't do it. Jesus has to step in and get them to condemn him. Because Jesus was keeping quiet, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't even trump up charges consistently enough to put this guy to death. You can't just have one guy bring a charge. You have to have two people say, hey, yes, we both heard him say the same thing. They couldn't even do that here in Mark. So Jesus, when they've frustrated, they've sinned, they've tried their best to find a way to put him to death, Jesus has to step up and give them a reason to do it. This is not normal, obviously. Not a normal person would do this. This is good irony. Jesus is really a lot more in control of the situation than anybody knows. Peter thinks it's all falling apart. The religious leaders think it's all going their way. Finally, they're going to get rid of this guy. Jesus is sort of sad because he knows he has to die, but he's really controlling this situation, taking it to exactly where it needs to go. Interesting literature, interesting way of going about things. Not at all what you would think, humanly speaking, God would want to do. Another big point here, it's fairly clear to the disciples throughout the gospel who Jesus is. Jesus makes it fairly obvious. They see enough things. He's explicit enough with them, still not terribly open, but still explicit enough with them for them to know what Jesus is talking about, even though they don't quite get him. That's not been true of the religious leaders at all. He has made a point of not really letting them know what he's thinking. He's not been showing them his hand. Take, for example, the parable of the tenants. He does this whole parable to say, okay, you are just like all the other prophets. All the other people in Jewish history. You've been killing the prophets. You are the enemies of God. And you know what? You're going to kill the Son too. What he doesn't do after that is say, by the way, I'm the Son of God and you're going to kill me to them. Right? He leaves it in the parable. He leaves it implicit for them. For the disciples, they would have seen it. But this whole messianic secret in Mark of Jesus trying to not let everybody know exactly what's going on with him, that comes to an end here, which is ultimately what gets him killed. He's kept it quiet so he could do his mission. Now it's time for him to die. And so he brings it up. And sure enough, that's ultimately what they can use to condemn him. Now let's talk about the charges. There's really two here. First is the one around the temple. And another is this whole charge of blasphemy. Now, whenever Jesus is on the cross, whenever they're talking to Jesus, what do they bring up? What charge do the jeering crowd actually use against Jesus? Yeah, they actually point to the tearing of the temple down. I don't think they actually even talk about this whole blasphemy thing, do they? It's really just the tearing of the temple. You might think they're actually not related, but they really are, if you understand what's going on with the blasphemy charge. What the religious leaders are trying to do is they're trying to get him on that. That is clearly irked to them. Why? Because as we've discussed, they're related to the temple. They're running it. You critique the temple, you critique those who run the temple. And so they're trying to get him on this. And sure enough, that's what they remember later when they want to make fun of him on the cross. Not even this charge of blasphemy. This just ends up being their way of saying, he's a blasphemer. According to our laws, we can put him to death. But they're actually a little bit more related to that. So let's discuss the idea of blasphemy. First of all, we read from Psalm 110. First verse, it says the Son of God would be sitting at the right hand of God. Right? Remember that? I just read it. If you look in verse 62 of Mark 14. I am, said Jesus, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power. And then Daniel 7:13, which we've seen many times, and coming with the clouds of heaven. The high priest asked him, after they can't get this temple charge to stick, he's going to go a different direction. We're going to try to finally tease out of Jesus who he says he is. We're going to try to catch him in that so we can find some reason to put this guy to death. So he says, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Calling God the Blessed One to avoid saying the name of God. Typical circumlocution. Jesus himself does it in the next verse. He says, Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power. Another way of saying God without actually saying his name, even though many times Jesus has said the name God. So what people will normally go with this, and I think this is just completely wrong for Mark, and I think misses a lot of the literary points that Mark is trying to go with throughout the whole gospel, is the way that most people will interpret this, is they'll take this passage and say, he's saying he's sitting at the right hand of God, he's admitting that he's called the Christ, and he's coming on the clouds in power. Jesus is here claiming he is God. Therefore, the religious leaders say, you just said that you were God, you're human, therefore, blasphemy, we can put you to death. That's where most people go. I think that's wrong. I don't think that's what's going on at all. We've actually seen all of these terms applied to Jesus before in Mark, right? There's actually nothing new about these statements. These have been really part of the focal point to say who Jesus was all of this time. There has never yet been a charge of blasphemy. Now, of course, the religious leaders have not been hearing this charge. They've not been hearing these self-statements. The disciples have. But these are normal terms. And as we've discussed them, as we've gone through this book, we've gone, look, in all of these cases, Jesus is not saying he's God. Jesus is saying he's the Messiah. Jesus is saying he's king. Jesus is saying he's going to rule over these people. We do, of course, believe that Jesus is God, but these are not what these terms have meant throughout Mark. There's really not any particularly good reason here to say that they mean anything different. They're terms of who the Messiah is. That's exactly what Jesus is claiming. So here's how they really fit in with the temple thing. We think of blasphemy as saying, you know what? I'm God. That would be blasphemous for me to say, right? Okay, good. I hope you think so, because if not, there's something wrong with you. Sorry. If I were to say that, that would be total blasphemy. If you look in the literature, if you look in how these guys talked and how these guys thought, you didn't actually have to go as far as to say, hey, I'm the covenant God of Israel, to actually get yourself called a blasphemer. All you needed to do is be against God and against his people and against his temple. That's what you needed to do. Because if you were to put yourself up and say, I'm good, everyone else, all of you guys are evil, the temple is corrupt, God is not with you, you are at that point a blasphemer. Why? God has already said that he's chosen you. God has already, he said he's going to put himself in this temple. That's what's going on. And this is how it actually fits in with the charge that they were going for. See, with this whole temple statement, they were going for this same statement that Jesus says explicitly two or three verses later. They were going, trying to tease out this, Jesus, tell us that you're against God. Tell us that you want to destroy the temple. Be explicit. Don't talk in parables. Don't hide it in circumlocutions. Don't tell it just to them. Say it to us so we don't have to trump up witnesses. So, you know, if he'll just say it out loud, we don't need witnesses because we're all witnesses because we're the court. We can hear you saying. Let's tease this out. They couldn't do it with the whole temple thing. But they did it here by explicitly asking Jesus. And Jesus says, fine. Lays it all out. It's time for him to die. Okay. I will be sitting at the right hand of God. I will be coming in the clouds of heaven to judge you for what you're doing to me right now. That is enough for them to say, you're against us, you're against the temple, you're against the people, you're against God, you're a blasphemer. It's time to kill you. That's what's going on here. It would be somewhat convenient to really have a nice statement here of the deity of Christ, but we get it plenty of other places. We don't really need to fight for it here, because it's really not. This way, it also fits much better in Mark. The whole goal of Mark has not really been in every single place to say, Jesus is God, Jesus is God, Jesus is God. That's not been the point. That's points other places, but not for Mark. Mark's main point is, that we've seen over and over and over again, is Jesus is God's special agent. He is the Messiah. He is here to create a new people, to judge those who are currently misplacing their trust in themselves and sin. He's here to judge those who are misleading the people. That's the point of Mark. The point of Mark is Jesus and his role, but not deity per se. So that's what's going on here. Now, this is not the typical take on this, because you know, if you don't look at the terms themselves and actually see what do they mean in this context, it's very easy to go, well, Jesus is calling himself God. He's saying he's at the right hand of God, and he's saying he's coming in the clouds of heaven. Clearly, he's God. No. None of those mean that, necessarily. He is, and he does sit on the right hand of God, and he did come, not will, did come on the clouds to the Ancient of Days and been given all authority and all power. That totally happened. But that's not what Jesus is saying here. But you see how this fits more into really to Mark's point. I mean, if you're looking, if you're deity hunting, we can call it that, if you're deity hunting in Mark and trying to find every single place in Mark where Jesus is calling himself deity, then you're probably going to find lots of other places in this. And every time he says that he's the Son of God, you're going to be saying, oh, well, Jesus is saying he's the Son of God. He's the second person of the Trinity. And so, therefore, you're going to find this very convincing that this is also a statement of Jesus' deity. When in all of the other cases, it makes better sense in Mark's point of Jesus saying, I'm the Messiah. I'm the King of Israel in the sense that David is the Son. I'm the Son. And then the further meaning that you get will definitely be something implied, and then later, especially in other writers, something more explicitly told. Even in John, talking about Jesus' life. But in Mark, this fits in better. Because this really puts Jesus saying the same thing he's been saying for chapters and chapters and chapters. He's not suddenly switching to a statement about his deity. Mark is not suddenly switching context to say, well, he's been anti-temple and anti-Jewish leadership all of this time. Now, boom, let's get him killed by saying he's God. Doesn't fit the context. But if you say that, well, this is just Jesus revealing his hand of who he is, it makes more sense. And I think that's the way you have to go with the blasphemy call. If you look at Exodus 22:27, for example, this is one verse that I saw somebody pointed out. In America, we are quite used to critiquing our leadership. In virtually all cases, it totally deserves it. Exodus 22:28 There's various commands in this chapter about what you're not supposed to do. 28, you shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people. Jesus was essentially doing that here. Now, he didn't say a curse word. But what do you think he means when he says, you'll see the Son of Man standing at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven? That's what he's meant all along. I'm coming to kill you. I'm going to come and judge you. I'm going to come and destroy you. He's cursing them. He's been cursing them. When he said in the parable of the tenants, well, what is God going to do after you kill the son? He's going to come kill you, and he's going to take this vineyard and give it to somebody else. This is all curse language, and this is exactly where Jesus is going. And that right there gives them plenty of law right there to put him to death, because he is now cursing their leadership. And, of course, they think they're winning. That's the fun thing, is they think they're winning. He's one guy by himself. They're on the outside. They've got the guards. They've got him down. We're totally winning. And then this pompous, arrogant man in the middle of the courtyard says, you can do with me what you want. I'm coming after you. This is high arrogance, unless he's right. All right? He's an incredibly arrogant person, a fool in their mind, saying, we've got you. We've got you surrounded. Your disciples have all fled. There's something wrong with you. You are an incredibly arrogant, blasphemous man. If he's wrong. But he's not wrong. He's totally right, which means he's not arrogant. He's exactly what he says he is, and he's going to come and take them down in more modern parlance. Now, one thing that's interesting, and this really fits in with our discussions on the Olivet Discourse. If you look, I think the tense and the person is pretty interesting in verse 62. I am, said Jesus, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. You will see. Not a future generation, 200 generations down the line will see. No, he's talking to them. He's talking to the ones who are condemning him, who are themselves, ironically, the arrogant ones trying to judge the Son of God. He's talking to them and saying, I'm coming for you on the clouds of heaven to judge you. That totally makes sense if you see this whole point of what we've been seeing in chapter and chapter again, that Jesus is saying the Jewish nation as a whole is about to be judged. Not to be judged sometime in the distant future, but in the very near future, about to be judged by God for their sinfulness, and especially their leadership for rejecting God and for not following his ways and rejecting his son, they're going to be judged. That's what Jesus is saying here. You will see the Son of God coming on the clouds of heaven in power. So that's where Jesus is going with this, and this is going to make them very angry. Jesus is giving them every conceivable reason to kill him. Because that's what Jesus wants. It's time. He's hidden it all this time. He's hid it behind parables. He's only talked to his disciples. Now, I'm coming for you. I am the Son of God. I'm the King of Israel, this guy that you're presuming to judge in your fake little court. And so, the high priest, he calls it heresy. He rips his clothes. He has him beaten. Now, one thing that's interesting here, as it's important to realize that it's not the Romans still. We're not there yet. Normally, when we think of Jesus being beaten, we normally have it just by the Romans, and they did as well. But you've got the Sanhedrin and its guards, not even the Roman guards, you've got the Sanhedrin, its guards, beating Jesus, humiliating Jesus. Given the point of Mark and given what he's saying about the depravity of these people, this totally fits. They are beating the Son of God. They are beating the very one that's going to come and judge them. It's incredibly ironic. Actually, I think that's mostly it. That's the main point.